This is 4:55 on Friday, September 9th. All right, please log into Clix as usual. There are more people in the room than have logged in, even though there are a lot of missing people. I think we will not start with the Clix questions. We're going to do one other thing first and then turn to the Clix questions. So if you will recall, last time we ended up talking about caching, and I said I wanted you to sort of remember again how the analysis of caching goes, the effect of caching goes. And you should have seen this in 2.6. You may see it in your operating systems classes, but it's the same analysis sort of regardless of where you encounter it, so it's good to make sure that we understand. So the idea is that we need to characterize how much goodness we get out of the caching. And the way we do that, in order to do that, we need to know a few things. We need to know the cost of a cache miss. We need to know the cost of a cache hit. And we need to know the miss rate, which is equal to 1 minus the hit rate. All right, so I can give you either one. I can give you the miss rate or the hit rate, and you can figure out the other one. So let's go over what this means. The cost of a cache miss is the time it takes to fetch the data when the data was not in the cache. The cost of a cache hit is the time it takes to fetch the data when the data was in the cache, and the other one is usually expressed as a percentage. So, for example, suppose I said that the cost of a cache miss was 1 second, and the cost of a cache hit was 0.1 seconds, and the miss rate was equal to, pick a number, miss rate
5
what? It's expressed as a percentage, so the miss rate is 5%. Okay, so the way we do it is then we say that the average cost is equal to, or the average delay is equal to the miss rate, times the miss cost plus 1 minus the miss rate, in other words, the hit rate, times the hit cost. Okay? And so in our example, this is, it is 5%, so that's 0.05 times 1 second plus 0.95 times 0.1 seconds is equal to 0.05 plus 0.095 seconds. In other words, approximately 0.06 seconds. No. Wrong. I should really do the addition. 0.145 seconds. Okay? That's all there is to it. But it comes up so often in sort of computer engineering, software engineering, design decisions, that it's something that you just need to get extremely familiar with so you can drag it up out of nowhere on a moment's notice and apply it to whatever situation you're in. All right? So, guess what? I've said it's important. I've gone over it in detail. What do you think that implies?
It's going to be on a test.
Definitely not on the exam.
Yeah, it's sort of going to be on the exam, isn't it? All right. Questions about this? And you can go back to the slides and see how they did it for the example that was in the slides. We're going to have a clicks question on it later today, so you'll get another practice at it in a moment, or in a while. Okay, so there are a few more people here. I wanted to save the procedural stuff until more people were here, but I guess this is all we're going to get. The TA has graded the homework ones. I will hand them back on Monday. Did everyone get my email about names on the homeworks? Did anyone not get any email from me about names on the homeworks? Okay, everybody got that. Then everybody also got the paragraph in that email about doing your own work. And that was engendered by a handful of assignments where that appeared not to be the case. Some acknowledged and some not. If you are amongst those who fall into the category where those things apply, then I think you should be getting in touch with me. I haven't heard from anyone. So if you work together with someone or you copied on the paper, I'd like to hear from you, because if I have to track you down, then things are going to be worse than otherwise. So we need to have a discussion. So I expect to hear from you with at least an email, if not a visit during office hours next week. Okay? Everybody understand? When I give an assignment, it is to be your own work unless it is explicitly given as a group assignment. All right. Hope that's the end of that for the semester. So, so we finished the web and HTTP talking about the caching. I told you we're not going to go over the slides about FTP, because you should not be using FTP, and except in very benign situations, so we won't do that. Instead, we're going to talk about email. And we all use email, and what isn't clear to me is how much people understand about how email works. And so there's a sort of calibration issue here about how much detail to talk about this in. And maybe you already all understand this, but I expect not. So we'll go through it, and if everybody says, oh, we already understand all of that, then maybe I'll ask at the end whether that was the case, or going along the way, just sort of deepen the discussion if with questions if it seems appropriate. So, email got started around the late 1970s, I think, is the accepted starting date when a guy at what was then called the Stanford Research Institute sent somebody somewhere else in the country over the ARPANET saying, hi, this is email, or something like that. This is a new system for communicating. And it sort of evolved for a while in various directions. And then we we sort of settled on this architecture for how it was going to work. So there are three pieces to email. There are what are called user agents. Those are the things that you interact with, the, you know, Thunderbird or Outlook or, you know, pick whichever one you're going to be using. There are mail servers, which are the servers that handle the moving of mail around in the network between each other. And there's a protocol for the mail servers to talk to each other called SMTP. There are also protocols for user agents to talk to mail servers. Those are much more varied. The thing that makes email work is not the fact that there are protocols like POP and IMAP and Outlook and other, and well, it's not called Outlook, but Microsoft's mail protocol. That isn't the thing that makes email work. The thing that makes email work is the existence of this protocol called SMTP, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, which is what the servers used to talk to one another. All right? Any questions about that? Then the user agents are going to talk to the mail servers in some way, which we'll get to. So, a mail server has a bunch of mail boxes on it, which is places where the mail for a particular user is stored. There's a queue of mail that the mail server is going to deliver to some other mail server. Okay, so these outgoing messages are delivered to mailboxes on some other server. Incoming messages are delivered to the mailbox locally, and so when you use your mail client to retrieve mail, you're pulling mail out of your mailbox on the server. When you're using your mail client to send mail, you're typically using SMTP itself in order to talk to the mail server. Now, Outlook and Exchange don't work this way, but if you have a sort of conventional mail client like Thunderbird or Pine or other things like that, or the Mac mail client, they will be using SMTP to talk to a mail server in order to deliver messages. Okay? Now, SMTP itself is another one of these protocols that is sort of dangerous. Sort of like, remember I said FTP is dangerous? SMTP is dangerous because without any further protection, it causes you to send your password in the clear over the network, and that's not a good thing. To fix that, typically what people do is that they combine SMTP with an encryption layer such as TLS, the Transport Layer Security protocol, and we'll see how that layering works. We're going to talk about protocol layering later in the class, but you can combine the two and end up with a protocol that is essentially SMTP, but carried over an encrypted connection. So you're not exposing your password. Plain SMTP, the well-known port, remember well-known ports, is 25. And when you do encrypted SMTP over TLS, there's a different port, which I don't remember. But it doesn't matter. Port numbers are just sort of arbitrary little things. Okay, so the way SMTP works is whenever somebody wants to send mail from either a user agent or a mail server to another mail server, the first thing you do is sort of say hello to the other mail server, and this is who I am, And then you transfer however many messages you want over this SFTP connection, because often if you're sending to a whole bunch of people on the same mail server, rather than establish a separate connection for each one, you can just say, here are all the people I want this to go to, and here's a message, and then here's another message I have going to this, to people on your server. Okay, so SMTP, like HTTP, is a sort of fully readable protocol. You can look at the ASCII text, and the messages themselves even are encoded as ASCII text. Even if you're sending attachments that are images, they get sort of mangled by the mail user agent into a form where there are no characters other than sort of 1, 2, or 5 to 127, right? The byte values. That's all that's allowed in SMTP. And so there are various encodings that do that. Okay, so how does it go? Think about this in terms of how you do mail. You use your user agent to compose the message, right? And then the user agent, then at some point you click send, and that causes your user agent to make an SMTP connection with your mail server, and places that message in your mail server's outgoing queue. So you don't, your mail user agent doesn't try to find out anything about Bob, right, at this point. It just sends the message to your mail server, and your mail server then opens, finds out where Bob's mail should go, what host it should go to, looks that up, and opens a connection with that, and delivers them using SMTP again, and then Bob's user agent ultimately comes along and reads the message with a mail reading protocol, which is not SMTP typically. Okay. This is, you may not have noticed this. This is a store and forward architecture. Right? We talked before about store and forward at the individual packet level. Here we're talking about it at the level of whole email messages. But yes, Alice's user agent sends the whole message to her mail server, and her mail server then sends the whole message to Bob's mail server, and so on. There can be, the mail server architecture allows for multiple steps to happen in here. That maybe Alice sends to a third party who then sends to Bob. And if you look at the headers of mail in your mail user agent, you can see all the steps that a mail message has gone through. Now, I don't know, I use Thunderbird, and I know how to see the sort of raw mail format in Thunderbird, which is control U when you're looking at a message. We'll open up the raw ASCII text of the mail message and show you all the headers. And here at WSU, this picture is much more complicated than is suggested here. Mail coming to WSU goes through through spam filters, malware filters, all kinds of things happen to the email before it actually lands on the EECS mail server or the WSU mail server. And if you look at the headers, you'll be able to see those steps. They say received by, and then they give a host name and a time. And this is often very, very useful for determining what has gone wrong when a mail message hasn't arrived. That mail that I sent to you Friday afternoon, for example, I sent it around 2:30 in the afternoon. At 3:30, it still hadn't shown up in my mailbox. And around 5 o'clock, it finally did, and I was able to look and see exactly where it was delayed, and I decided it wasn't interesting. But sometimes it's interesting why a mail message has been delayed. So Like I said, it's ASCII. The S and the C here stand for server client. And it's sort of interesting in this protocol, although the client makes the connection, does the initial reaching out to the server, it's the server who says the first thing. The server says a magic number and who it is, and then the client issues this hello command. For some reason, they decided that we weren't going to spell these out in real English. We just have sort of an approximate English. So it's H-E-L-O, and gives its identity, and the server comes back and says hello, hello again, with the 250 message, and then the client says, I'm going to give you some mail, and it's from this person, and the server at this point is allowed to say, I don't want to talk to you. And sometimes this is used, well, often these days, this is used to prevent people from connecting to arbitrary mail servers to send mail. This is what's known as an open relay, and it's a huge security hole and a huge facilitator of spam. So largely in the world of today, mail servers will not accept mail unless it's from somebody who's local to them. And so this server is willing to accept this one. I sort of overstated that. Will not accept mail from somebody who doesn't belong to them unless it is going to somebody who belongs to them. So I can send mail to somebody at Cornell, right? Because I'm sending to Cornell and I'm using the Cornell mail server to do that. But if I were trying to send mail to somebody at WSU using the Cornell mail server, that would fail. Okay? So anyway. And then comes the body of the message, and then there's a dot to end the message. So how did messages end in HTTP? Remember that?
Carriage
return line feed, essentially a blank line.
Yeah.
Here, mail messages end with a dot all by itself. Well, it sort of makes sense because an email message might have blank lines in it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm leading you down the garden path that statement. The headers in HTTP messages end with blank lines, but the body, remember the body, we have a header that says how long it is. There's no header here that says how long it is. Right? So a line that has a dot on it ends the a period on it ends the message, which means that if we have a line in our message that has a period on it all by itself, we need to do something about that called escaping it. Because otherwise it would end the message, right? And just a little complicated, right? Like hard, but these are the practicalities. I don't know these days of any server that you can do this with around here, because they, most of them don't talk on port 25 anymore because they require passwords for sending things. So, okay. Well, this is a bit of interesting terminology. We use these terms pull and push about protocols to indicate sort of who is doing the initiation of the transfer. So in the case of HTTP, it's the client who contacts the server and says, give me stuff, right? It's pulling stuff. In the case of SMTP, it's the client who contacts the server and says, here's stuff I want you to have. So that's pull and push, right? Useful terminology to know. All right. So once we have the SMTP protocol, which is what I just talked about, there's also a standard about what the body of a message is supposed to look like, right? Because just saying that the mail is coming from this person and going to that person, which is all that's part of SMTP, is not enough. We also want to have things like to fields and from fields and CC fields and date fields and all of that stuff. And that's the realm of the RFC 822 message format. So this looks more like the HTTP stuff, where there's a bunch of headers and then a blank line and then the body of the message. Okay. Alright, so then in addition to SMTP, there are the protocols that user agents use to retrieve mail. The common ones are POP, the Post Office Protocol. This is an ancient protocol. It goes back to the probably mid-1980s. It's a very simple protocol, and it's a protocol for user agents to get mail off of the server, and the expectation is that you will take the mail off of the server and it will be gone from the server. Modern use of POP tends to allow you to leave messages on the server, but if you try to use multiple machines to do popping off the same mail server, experience suggests that this is not a viable configuration. You will get in situations where you end up with duplicate messages in your mail client. You will get situations where mail seems to disappear and you never see it on one of the clients or another. That's kind of a mess. So slightly less ancient is IMAP, which is a protocol that really is designed that you leave your messages on the mail server and view them from wherever. And that's what I would say most people are using these days, unless they're using something like Gmail or Hotmail, which are sort of customized mail user protocols for interacting with a particular kind of mail server. So you don't use the Gmail protocol to talk to anything except Gmail. You don't use Hotmail to talk to anything except. They're non-standard, right? And it doesn't matter that they're non-standard because everybody has a particular mail server that they use, and they have a client for talking to that mail server, and everybody's happy. Okay, so that part doesn't have to be standardized, but SMTP is the glue, and that is very much standardized. We're not going to go through POP. I think that just says what I said already. All right, so at this point, I want to stop and see if there are questions, confusions, observations from your use of email. Anybody have any? Does this explain something that you didn't know before, or did you know all this before? Sir?
For HTTP, you said it's full and then SMTP is pushed. Can you
right.
expand on that?
Sure. So think about HTTP, the way you get to web page. Your machine, your browser, contacts the server and says, give me this page. Right? So that's a sort of pull model. Right, that the client is pulling from the server. In the case of SMTP, the client contacts the server and says, I want to give you this email. Right? I want to push this email to you. Okay? And that's the difference. Other questions? So what do you... Yeah.
Would a user agent be smart enough to know if it can avoid sending an email to the server if they send it to yourself? It might vary on the actual user agent.
It would vary based on the user agent, but I think the complication of having a different pathway is it needs more code, and people would normally just say
forget about it. Just send it there. Other questions? So is there new here? And does it explain the phenomena that you see? I mean, I think it does. So I hope it's useful. All right. Before we go on, about three people have said they're lost at this point. And I don't know when that started. Have we got the questions? Okay. If you need to ask me a question by email later, please feel free. So now I want to turn back and do the clicks questions for today. If we can do that. So these are going to review some of the HTTP stuff and maybe some of the email stuff as well. Can see it's taking a while for this information to sort of cycle back into the brain. So, all right, let's see what we've got here. Well, there's a lot of disagreement about this. Let's analyze each of these in turn.
Which is true. GET requests cannot convey form data. Now, yes, they can, right? Remember we talked about the form which form data is strung out into the URL as part of the GET request. POST requests convey form data in the URL part of the request. No, that's the GET requests that do that. GET requests convey form data in the entity body part of the request. No, that's the POST requests that do that. So it better be this one. POST requests convey form data in the entity body part of the request. Yeah. All right, so.
Okay, what's the major advantage of HTTP 1.1 over 1.0? About 3/4 of you have answered, but I think we need to move on. So let's do this. Whoops. How did that happen? Yeah, it is A. In some sense, the purpose of HTTP 1.1 is to avoid the need to use multiple connections to get things to go faster. That's a technique you can use in 1.0. And encrypted connections, just don't confuse HTTP 1.1 with HTTPS, the secure version of HTTP. Now, we just did this, so I expect fast answers. Show. Yeah, this is false. User agents and mail servers are different things. All right. Now, this question is an example of a question that asks for critical thinking. There are multiple answers. There are multiple statements among the answers that are true, but what I'm really asking you to think about is more of the why of this than just what's true. Okay? So the purpose of using mail servers is what? Well, here's how I think about this. It's a thinking exercise, so we sort of have to discuss what we mean by the purpose and these various statements. So I think all four of them are, in some sense, true to some extent. So, what?
That's not fair.
No, I told you they were... The multiple things were true, but only one of them is really the purpose. Okay? So, let's go at them from the bottom. Allow mail to be stored for a long period of time. Is it essential for email to work that it be possible to store email for a long period of time on the server? Not really, right? Because you know, if I retrieve my email, I can store it locally. So yeah. they probably didn't decide on this architecture for that reason. To implement a store and forward architecture. Well, it certainly is a store and forward architecture, but is that the purpose of using servers? Not really. Right? That's the approach that's used to accomplish some other goal. To ensure that the FBI can read any email that you send. They weren't thinking about that at the time, although there's been a lot of discussion more recently about whether that would be a good thing or not. So people don't even agree that that's a good thing, right? So it's probably not the purpose of doing it this way. Although the FBI sometimes would like to do that. Allow mail to be sent to a recipient who is currently offline. That really seems to be essential, right? If I'm going to send email to someone and they're offline, it really, and there were nothing in the system to deal with that,
then email wouldn't work. So, my thinking, and this is the answer is A, even though all four of the others are true to at least some extent, they are not really the purpose. Any discussion about that? Somebody want to disagree with me? I won't hold it against you if you do. All right, so I promised you a practice about caching. So here's our practice about caching. So, if I were to ask this question on an exam, what would I want as an answer? Not just the number.
The unit.
I would want the units, and I really expect to see a formula for the calculation with the numbers filled in. Shall we do that? I haven't. Only one person has answered so far, and they just gave me a number.
Oh,
at least I only see one answer. I suspect maybe that I left the thing running somewhere else and it's sucking up some of the answers. So shall we do it? As rather than proxy cache server with an average response time of 0.1 and a hit rate of 20%. So that tells me that the answer is 0.1 times 0.2 plus the miss time is 1 second and the miss rate is 0.8, right, seconds equals something's sucking up answers because I didn't even see my answer. Alright. One last one. So this is another kind of critical thinking sort of question. We haven't really talked about this, but what do you think? Remember that the hit time was 0.1 seconds, the hit rate was 20%. here's how I think about this. The hit rate, the external traffic is reduced if the request is satisfied from the cache. Right? That's what it means. That's the thing that reduces the external traffic. And so how often does that happen? 20% of the time, the hit rate. So that's how much traffic is not presented to the external traffic. 20%. Okay? Good. All right. Any questions about that? Like I said, become familiar with how those things work and what they mean. We have one more topic to do before we get to actually doing some programming in this class, which we'll start talking about next Monday. And that's the domain name system. So this is an interesting protocol, DNS, in that it's both sort of fundamental to the way the internet works. Right? If we didn't have it, it would be sort of really difficult to use the internet. It's fundamental, and yet it's at the application layer. Right? Kind of weird. And the purpose of the DNS, the domain name system, is to help us go from user-sensible names, like www.wsu.edu, to IP addresses. Remember, IP addresses are 4-byte numbers. If we had to remember that WSU, if we had to remember a great big number as the address of www.wsu.edu, we probably wouldn't ever actually have built the web because nobody would be able to do it. So DNS is the thing that translates from user-sensible names to the IP address numbers that we need in order to actually do communication on the internet, because the actual interactions at the network layer take place using those addresses that are numbers. The problem associated with that's a simple idea, right? Names and numbers. The problem is that there are billions of numbers and billions of names, and it probably isn't going to work to have a central location where all of those things are recorded. And so DNS was implemented as a distributed database system in which responsibility for pieces of the namespace, that is the human sensible names, can be delegated to different organizations that actually have some interest in that piece of that namespace. Okay. So I think we are essentially out of time today. We will finish DNS and then we'll start to talk about socket programming on Monday.